Back at it today, you and I together on Monday, March 7th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. I kicked off the show wondering why we're suddenly making overtures now to buy more oil from dictators. Meantime, University of New Haven finance and economics instructor David Sacco chimed in on the controversy over whether or not to cut off Russian oil imports into the U.S. Our military and intelligence analyst Brian Boyd joined us again to talk about the tactical aspects of the current war in Ukraine.
We're entering the part of this that a lot of people knew would be coming, and this meaning, you know, what is the what is the U.S. going to do? What can the U.S. do? What is the primary thing the U.S. can do to perhaps make up for some shortfall in Russian oil, in Russian oil imports? Because it certainly looks like now, by everything you and I can read, it certainly looks like that there's a groundswell in Congress, in the House, in the Senate, on both sides, a Republican and Democrat, to buck the White House, if you will, buck the White House with a B, to tell them, hey, we've got to stop importing Russian oil here. Okay, we know it's going to eventually drive up the price at the pump, and I've got some prices here in front of me. I'll get to those momentarily, but the prices at the pump for regular gas, for diesel, wow, for heating oil, too, all these things are going to go up. We know that. So we've hit the inevitable now, and the question continues to be, how do we make up for what we are not going to have? Because, again, you and I talked about this last week, where you look at the various numbers, and on the low end, it's 3-4%. On the high end, it's 8-9%. But most experts are saying that we end up importing about 7% of our overall oil from Russia and Russian companies and all that. So again, so what do you do here? How do you make up for the gap you're going to have here? Because you're going to have to fill a little bit of a hole here. You know what I mean? You have to fill a hole here if you're not going to have this Russian oil coming in here. Well, from what I am reading now, the U.S. is about to, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to make this political, but you have to at this point. Ladies and gentlemen, we are about to embarrass ourselves on the world stage. We are. And I'm telling you, the Republicans, this coming November, they should and I think will make this a campaign issue. Because, look, I know we're rallying around the Ukraine flag and rallying for the people of Ukraine. But, you know, some things that we may see, it's not definite, but, you know, some of the things we may be seeing here, it's just going to be embarrassing here. Let me give you point number one here. This is out of the Washington Post. Now, this is hardly, pardon me, this is hardly a right-wing newspaper. So you can say, well, Paul, this is coming from some right-wing fringe thing like the Daily Signal or the Washington Times. No, this is coming from the Washington Post. You ready for this? U.S. officials, you sitting down for this? Seriously, sitting down. This is embarrassing. How utterly embarrassing is this? You ready for this? U.S. officials make rare trip to Venezuela, discuss resuming oil imports to help replace Russian fuel. It was the highest level U.S. visit to the government of authoritarian socialist, yes, that guy, Nicolas Maduro. We haven't talked to him in years about anything, but now, because we are not pumping all the oil we can possibly pump. And I know what you're saying. Well, you know, they're sitting on these leases and this, that, and the other. No, we should have an infrastructure. We should have a pumping and drilling policy where we can just do this, flip a switch if we can, and hike production if we can. So you ready for this? So now we're going hat in hand, to Venezuela, led by an authoritarian socialist dictator, Nicolas Maduro. This is not me making this up. Oh, it gets better. I've got more stuff here, too. You're going to love the next one, too. Get this. In the Washington Post, a group of senior U.S. officials flew to Venezuela on Saturday for a meeting with President Nicolas Maduro's government to discuss the possibility of easing sanctions on Venezuelan oil imports as the Biden White House weighs a plan to ban imports of Russian oil and gas. That's according to two people familiar with the situation. Imagine that. And I don't care whose fault it is, the oil companies, the day traders, the currency traders, the federal government, the environmentalist nuts on the left. This is embarrassing. Really? So we sanction dictators when we don't need them, but we kiss the arse of other dictators when we do need them. The trip, the Post reports, is the highest-level U.S. visit to the socialist state in years and comes as the U.S. is seeking to isolate Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. Venezuela, you get this? Now, folks, listen to this. I'm not making this up. I'm reading this out of the liberal-leaning Washington Post. Venezuela, the Kremlin's most important ally in South America, used to be a significant supplier of crude oil to the U.S. before exports were hobbled by domestic mismanagement and crippling sanctions from Washington. Yes, Venezuela, folks, should have an outstanding standard of living. They don't. They used to. But again, when the socialists took over there, what do you think? In recent weeks, former American lawmakers have pushed for the U.S. to ban Russian oil and gas exports while lifting limits on Venezuela, the home to the world's largest oil reserves. Venezuelans should be living like kings and queens. They used to for a time. They're not. Who went down there to talk to Venezuela? The delegation included Roger Carstens, the special presidential envoy for hostage affairs. Yeah, they're holding us hostage, all right. Juan Gonzalez, the National Security Council's senior director for Western Hemisphere Affairs, and Jimmy Story, the U.S. ambassador to Venezuela, said one person familiar with the visit. Now, nobody is admitting to this. The Washington Post just has its sources. This is Jimmy Carter, too, all over again. The trip comes just days after Maduro and, ding, 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 you're a winner, Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke over the phone about boosting the partnership between their countries. So we're not going to buy from Russia, which I agree with. So we're going to go buy from Venezuela, who is now hat in hand with Moscow. What an utter embarrassment this is. This is an utter freaking embarrassment. During the trip, U.S. officials are also trying to secure the release of six former executives of Houston-based Citgo Petroleum. That's according to a person familiar with the visit. Now, yes, Venezuela is hosting hostages. That's another point. But my God, how embarrassing. Seriously? Really? We're going to go kiss the backside now of dictators to get oil? This is why you don't listen to the environmental nuts. You work with the oil companies, the government does, and say, hey, what is the most you can pump? Let's marshal other reserves here. Because you don't think this is going to happen again? Come on. Putin's laughing. Two-thirds of the world is laughing at us right now. What an absolute joke. Joining us right now, a return visit from one of our go-to guys. He's a practitioner in residence of finance from the Pompeia College of Business at the University of New Haven, a nationally recognized expert in investment trends, analysis of stocks, cryptocurrency, Dogecoin, and more. We welcome back David Sacco to WICC. Hey, David, it's Paul again. Thanks for coming back. How are you?
Good, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. Boy, David, we're some crazy times right now. You folks that follow this stuff, look at the prices, look at commodities. Your heads must be spinning with this stuff, David. I mean, it changes not just day to day, but hour to hour. Give us your overview here on, you know, what's going on and how bad could this get?
Well, I think the key word is volatility. So if you think about the price of oil today, which is sitting here watching a business news channel just noted that it's at a 13-year high. It was less than 2 years ago that the price of crude oil, obviously at the beginning of the pandemic, was literally negative. So it was below zero. So obviously we've seen, you know, incredible volatility. Oil is just such an economic harbinger for so many reasons. So many aspects of our economy are affected by it. So I think when events like this happen, we tend to see a lot of volatility in the price movement of oil because it's so critical to the rest of our economy.
You know, I was having discussions with callers, with experts on this over the past couple of weeks. David, can you explain for my listeners what role the middlemen have here, middlemen, middle women, let's be fair here, who set commodities prices for oil futures and trading? How much does that play into what you and I are paying at the gas pump versus this daily volatility that you talk about?
Sure. So the commodity markets, the middlemen just sort of act as brokers, right? Ultimately, it's the demand that, you know, starts with how much we drive and how much gasoline we put in our cars. But obviously, the bigger part of that is diesel fuel and how much goes into trucks that are shipping things and heating oil. So, you know, driving is just sort of the tip of the iceberg. And obviously, we all know that, you know, gasoline is one of the few commodities where we see price changes every day. That's because the market is so efficient. So, you know, one thing I was looking at today is that typically there is a lag between the price of crude oil and the price of gasoline. And typically it's about a 2 week lag. So as high as gas prices are right now, I think what's important for people to understand is that the price move in underlying crude oil has gone up by 25% since where it was 2 weeks ago. So if the normal trend holds, that means 2 weeks from now, we're probably looking at gasoline prices of over $5 a gallon.
And now this scenario here, David Sacco, who's the guest from the University of New Haven, where there are now, David, there's a growing rumbling on both sides of the aisle in both chambers of Congress, kind of, you know, bucking what the White House wants to do here. You know, the White House is saying, no, we can't cut off Russian oil. Well, that was last week. Now, after a weekend of all the political shows on, there seems to be unity on that. So, David, what happens if that, and the figure everybody's using is about 7% of our imports, what happens if the spigot is turned off on that 7% or turned down, shall we say, to 93%? What happens to the economy, to the gas markets? What do you think?
So here's where maybe there's a little bit of a silver lining in that the price of oil is up, like I said, 25% in 2 weeks in the market and even more over a 4 or 5 week period. But the reality is the supply fluctuations have not been too bad, right? So the market price increase has been mainly based on anxiety about what might happen. Right. So far, we're still buying Russian oil. The Europeans, who drive a lot more of their energy use from Russian oil, are still buying Russian oil. And we haven't cut off the spigot yet. Right. So in one sense, this price rise is more based on what people think might happen than what's actually happened. So potentially, and again, the markets are very volatile and you never know how they're going to react. But potentially, once we announce sanctions that actually cut off the flow of oil from Russia, you know, what often happens in the stock market is people sell the rumor, right? We're afraid something's going to happen, so we get nervous and we push prices up or down. And then when the actual event happens, generally it's not as bad as we thought it would be, and then prices might come back into line a little bit. So, you know, I don't want to sit here and tell you that prices are going to go up further if we cut off Russian oil, because, in fact, that might have the effect of actually bringing prices back down a little bit as there's more certainty in the market at that point about what's going to happen.
David Sacco is a guest from the University of New Haven. You know, David, I joke here about the only thing I remember, David, being hung over in my college economics classes is the theory of elasticity, right? You know how this works. Guy like you, high supply, low demand is cheap. Low supply, high demand, it's more expensive. Even a dummy like me can understand that. But if David, this 7% or 6 or 7% of Russian oil goes away, and the demand stays the same or even goes a little higher with summer driving and folks want to get out, could that be the moment when the prices at the pump get tenuous?
Well, I mean, they're already tenuous, right? And then, of course, the flip side is the other side of the equation is, the government now is talking with the Saudis and Venezuelans and potentially even Iran, right, if we cut a deal. So there are other people out there who could make up the shortfall, right? Remember, OPEC limits the production of oil, right? So, and Russia is part of OPEC, but the Arab countries could decide to increase their production, right? They regulate production, so it's possible that we could see other suppliers step up and fill that gap. And I suspect that's what's probably being negotiated behind the scenes now. Again, I would attribute the price increase in the last 3 weeks doesn't make sense given the fact that the supply really hasn't changed. So when the supply does change, I do think the market will look at the amount of the supply change, sit there and say, is it more or less than we thought? And if there's another supply that comes in to back it up, I suspect that we'll see prices correct, not all the way back down to where they were, but we certainly could see a stabilization or a little bit of a downward correction. So, my guess is we're probably still 2 weeks away from the peak gas prices just because of the lag impact in terms of where oil is now. But I would be a little surprised if they went up much higher than that.
And David, final question. I'm hearing from experts, and we had discussions on my show about this over the past couple of weeks, people who point out and experts who say, the oil companies, the domestic oil companies have a big part in this too. And, because, David, as you mentioned, supply and demand and needing a profit margin for their shareholders, some of these oil companies may not be chomping at the bit if they could to up production to get us through this. How much power do they really have, David? Because some of these companies are saying, hey, it's not us. Don't look at us. We're doing what we can. You buy that or not?
Well, I think we sometimes tend to conflate price with profit margin, right? So the oil companies, yes, when the price of oil is higher, it gives them more profit incentive to increase the amount of oil they're extracting from the ground. The flip side is there's regulatory constraints, right? Our government policy for the last few years has been to, reduce the amount of oil produced, and not just the government, but also investors, because the one thing about the oil business is that it's very capital intensive. So when the price of oil goes up, oil companies spend a lot of money trying to get more oil out of the ground. And then, of course, when the price goes down, they have to shut off that capacity. So investors have been demanding that the oil companies be a little more studious about how they do that and when they invest. So, oil companies will produce as much oil as they can when prices are high because it's going to increase their profits. It's that next level of investment that they need to make that either the regulatory uncertainty or the demand of investors could prevent. So I think there's some validity to what they're saying.
David Sacco, thanks. Practitioner in residence of finance from the Pompeii College of Business at the University of New Haven. David, always good to share some time with you. We appreciate it. Thank you, sir. We'll talk down the road.
Thank you, Paul.
All right, there you go. David Sacco, MBA, a practitioner in residence of finance at the Pompeii College of Business at the University of New Haven. So the thing you take out of that chat we had with David, 2 weeks. What did he say? There's a 2-week lag between what you see at the gasoline pumps, what you and I pay, what we put or take out of our debit cards versus, what we think is going on. In other words, the oil numbers we're seeing today will be reflected in 2 weeks. How's about that? Well, the offensive, the war, I guess we could say, in Ukraine from a military tactical point of view. What is going on? Well, Welcome back. Our Connecticut Today military analyst, Brian Boyd, is a 30-plus year professional intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist, law enforcement pro. He's a former Green Beret. He was part of the leadership of the Joint Special Ops Command, which oversees Special Forces, SEAL Team 6, and Delta Force. He also served in the Departments of Defense, Justice, and Treasury. Regularly appears on radio and TV discussing intelligence matters. The website, BoydIntelligence.com. Brian Boyd, Paul here at WICC in Connecticut. Good to have you back. How are you?
Nice to talk to you. I hate to be under such circumstances, though.
Yeah, tough stuff, Brian. So I wanted to have you back on because from a military point of view, from a purely, Brian, operational and intelligence point of view, I need people to tell me and guys like you to tell me what you're seeing here. What do you see so far, Brian, as we approach 2 weeks on this?
Well, the big picture is this, because you got to look back at the history of how he took over the Crimea and Georgia in 2008, and Crimea in 2014. He has had a long-range plan. He's planned this. He's been openly, it's an open secret. He's been made it very clear in his writings in July of last year. He said he was going to do it. He's doing exactly what he said he was going to do. Now, tactically, he's gotten bogged down because in the past, he has learned historically, even going all the way back to Hitler, that if you scare the bejeebies out of somebody, they'll cut and run. He saw that happen in Afghanistan with our people. He saw it in other countries. So he was expecting to see Zelensky run, and he was rather surprised that the man did not leave the country, did not take safe haven in the United States, decided to stay and fight. So that threw his timetable off. But you've got to remember, he doesn't care what the odds are. He is so myopic, he is determined to completely encircle and encase Ukraine. Now, the tactics he's using are the same ones he's used before. Kill the civilians. Don't kill the military. Basically destroy the will of the people by starving them to death. If you look at the map of what's going on, the north, east, and the south, doesn't matter if it looks like he's bogged down. His plan is to act like a python. He's going to slowly, slowly encircle these cities and starve them to death and freeze them out. I don't know a lot of people know this, but the nuclear attack on the nuclear plants, that feeds the electricity for Ukraine. And if he could shut off the lights and the electricity in the wintertime, he could freeze these people out and starve out the population. He does not care how many civilians die. He eventually wants to repopulate it probably with Russian citizens. So he has absolutely no fear, no concern for the human population over there.
Brian, before we go to break, I want to ask you this. There's been so many people speculating, from the top people in the State Department to specialists who look at the guy. You know, they speculate, Brian, is he losing it? The COVID isolation. I read something earlier in my show that, you know, he could be all up on steroids because of some sort of cancer. Could he be doing this, Brian, or is he as cold, as rational as he's ever been?
Well, historically, he's still cold and rational. If you go all the way back to his youth and learn about how he wanted to be in the KGB, as a young kid, he admitted he was a thug. He's small in stature. He took judo because he wanted to learn how to manipulate and handle people. And he learns to fight like a rat. When a rat's cornered, it attacks. So that's been his philosophy. And he's always been this way. Now, he applied to be a KGB agent. They told me he couldn't do it. He was told to go to law school in the military. So he ended up being a lieutenant colonel. And his last year of law school, he got recruited to the KGB. Where his life got turned around is when Yeltsin took him under his wing. And when Yeltsin was trying to get out of the presidency because he was a drunk and he was filled with a lot of corruption, he basically took Putin, who he appointed as his intelligence chief. You got to remember where he came from. He was head of the intelligence services in 98, 99. And then he called Bill Clinton up, I think in 1999, 2000, and told Clinton that this was going to be the next president of Russia and you could trust him. So that's how he came to power. It wasn't because he was elected fairly. He was appointed and he worked his way up through the system. Now, if you know that has been his history, and he projected he was going to take Georgia, he said he was going to take Crimea, nothing has changed in his behavior. We can speculate about his health. But still, he's very focused and very myopic. He's not going to stop until somebody physically stops him or the Russian army is pummeled. You know, it's not going to stop. He just will not stop.
Brian, hang on. We're talking to Brian Boyd, 30-plus a year, professional intelligence analyst, counterterrorism specialist. He's worked for three departments in D.C. Brian, hang on. Stay there. We'll be right back with you. Want to get more into this, and we'll ask Brian coming up. So if you're on the other side of this, NATO, the U.S., the Ukraine military, can they inflict more pain and damage on Putin? Maybe change his mind. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Military and intelligence analyst Brian Boyd back on the program for a few more minutes. We like to tap into Brian to give us his thoughts when there's military or intelligence conflicts in the world. So, Brian, let's take the flip side here, my friend. You're in NATO, you're in the Pentagon, you're in all these other countries, you're in the Ukraine military. What can be done here? What would give the Russian forces under Putin the most problem here? What would you do?
Well, there's only three things that we can do on our side of the table. Number one, Putin holds all the cards. Everybody involved, NATO, the United States, we're on our back foot. We are off balance. We've come on board with NATO too little, too late. The only thing we can do is supply them with as much weaponry as you can, javelins and stingers, and they can inflict a lot of damage on the Russian troops. But eventually, the overwhelming odds, the overwhelming power of the Russian army, which has no reason to stop moving forward because they're under the command and control of Putin, they're eventually still going to smother out and encircle these cities. That's why the bombing has been on the outskirts and not try to do major targets. By doing indiscriminate bombing of the civilian population, he's trying to drum them into submission. Now, the problem is with Zelensky. If Zelensky dies as a result of the Russian horde, he will become a martyr. He'll become another icon of a beacon of success. And the Russians don't want that to happen. They want him to surrender so they can label him a coward. But if he dies in position or he dies in the process, the Russians will be faced with a guerrilla war for 20 or 30 years for the rest of time immemorial. The other thing is the nations themselves, the NATO nations, can continually supply him with stuff. The only other side of the coin, it has to come with our politics here. And I don't want to sound like I'm picking on a particular administration, but we need to reinstitute our energy independence. If we can do that, it'll take us out of the horrible mess we're in with our gas prices. It'll dry up the Russian money, the Russian oil money, and that is the quickest way to shove them down. The sanctions are not enough to do it. But if you dry up their oil money, stop buying oil from him, then that can actually stuff the juggernaut. It'll also keep us from being in a deep hole and causing us horrible problems. So on that domestic side, that has to be done. I don't think this administration is going to do that.
Brian, any shot do you think, and this has been mused about by people, so why not? You know, Operation Valkyrie in World War II, Brian, great movie that was done years ago by Hollywood and Tom Cruise, that almost took out Adolf Hitler were it not for the bomb being a little bit further away under the table. But do you think that Putin is so protected now that if somebody in his inner circle of the government there said, hey, this is killing our country here, we're going to be in a hole here for years, is he so well protected that nobody's going to be able to take him out if there was a thought of doing that, Brian, internally in the Kremlin or in Russia?
There's been talk of that on radio and TV. There's various politicians who've spoken up saying he needs to be taken out. Some of the talking heads on the other TV stations are saying they should take him out. That's certainly a major choice. If that occurs, his successor would then have a way out of the mess they're in. But let's just take a for instance. Let's say he's taken down by somebody. Yeah. The replacement may or may not be worse, but the choice is that person who replaces him will then be able to withdraw from the mess that the Russians are in. You got to remember, Putin's entire point of view is this. He believes the United States and Russia are inevitably on a path to war. He believes that. He writes about it. He's a murderer. He worships power, and he has absolutely no ethical framework and no moral compass. That's why he's able to do what he does. You could give an analogy to Hitler. Hitler was just unstoppable. So, yes, that is a scenario that would make a difference, but you can't count on that right now. As you said, he's very well protected. And everybody that's even come close to replacing one of the ears has either been murdered or poisoned.
Yeah. The website, Boyd Intelligence, B-O-Y-D, BoydIntelligence.com. Brian, good to hear from you. Brian Boyd, thank you. Be good, be safe, Brian, and we'll undoubtedly talk down the road on this. Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me, Paul.
Brian Boyd there. Brian, thank you. All right, there you go, folks. Yeah, he's taking it from a military and intelligence point of view. So, you know, could Putin get taken out? Maybe, maybe. But again, as Brian said, as I said earlier, there's no sign of this guy backing off. Interesting, though, what Brian said about Zelensky, that the Russians, the Putin wants him to surrender, the symbolism of him surrendering. And if he's killed in battle or by a sniper or something, that might inflame the Ukrainian people even more.